Savagery, Book 9, The Book of Eternal Night, Canto 2, The Journey in Eternal Night, and the Voice of the Darkness. This is Part 1. It's on pages 582 through 585. Savitri is following Satchavan's luminous spirit as he passes through the opening in the conscious rocks, which are the gateway into the inconscient. We saw that as she was about to enter, Death pealed forth his vast, abysmal cry to stop her. Death said, "O mortal, turn back to thy transient kind. Aspire not to accompany Death to his home, as if thy breath could live where time must die." But Savitri opposes Death. We already saw that Death had to tell her to draw back her heart's powerful force, which was holding on to Satyavan's body so strongly that even Death could not take his immortal spirit. And when she rose to face Death, and she looked at Death for the first time, Sri Aurobindo wrote, "The two opposed each other with their eyes, woman and universal God. The woman opposes Death from their very first contact." When Death first tells Savitri to go back, because mortals cannot survive beyond time, Sri Aurobindo shows us that our soul is beyond mortality and beyond time, and we can survive. Savitri has realized her immortal soul, which always passes through birth and death, and rebirth and death and rebirth, in time, beyond time, in time, beyond time. And now her soul is in the front of her being, guiding her being. And also now, her immortal Jivatman is also fully active in her being. Death cannot perceive this. Death, by its very nature, denies man's true state of immortality, and Savitri has to conquer Death to deal with this. So Savitri ignored Death's warning. Sri Aurobindo gave us an incredibly beautiful description of Savitri's wordless answer. He wrote, "The woman answered not. Her high nude soul, stripped of the girdle of mortality, against fixed destiny and the grooves of law, stood up in its sheer will a primal force. Still, like a statue on its pedestal, lone in the silence, and to vastness bared, against midnight's dumb abysses piled in front, a columned shaft of fire and light, she rose." Now, at the beginning of this canto, as Savitri begins her journey in eternal night, Sri Aurobindo describes the journey of death in negative psychological states. These are all human attitudes which need to be purified out of human consciousness in order to move beyond death. This is Savitri's story, so we experience what she experiences, what she sees and thinks and feels. Western cultures and religions say that right after we die, our soul goes through purgatory, and once it's been purged or purified, then we are either to go up to heaven or down to hell. In one of Sri Aurobindo's letters, in the Letters on Yoga, Sri Aurobindo wrote, "Hell and heaven are often imaginary states of the soul, or rather, of the vital being, which it constructs around it after its passing. What is meant by hell is a painful passage through some vital world, or a dolorous lingering there, as in many cases of suicide, one remains surrounded by forces of suffering and turmoil created by this unnatural and violent exit. There are also, of course, real worlds of mind and vital worlds which are penetrated with joyful or dark experiences. One may pass through these as a result of things formed in the nature which create the necessary affinities. Mother and Sri Aurobindo teach that during life, things enter into us and affect us because we have something inside of us which responds to them. Sri Aurobindo wrote, "After people leave the body in the death process, they pass through certain vital and mental worlds, or they pass through certain psychological states which are the results of their actions in life and their individual nature." Mother and Sri Aurobindo explain that when we can purify ourselves of lower things, we can be free from their effect on us from the outside. Now we see that this affinity continues to affect us after we leave the body. If we are open to dark forces from a dark level of the vital, we are still subject to them when the body dies. We are attracted to go to that place where they are, and they will take more advantage of us than they did in our life, because our body is not there for protection. Sri Aurobindo wrote in another letter, "It is only the first part of this transit that can be dangerous or painful. In the rest, one works out, under certain surroundings, a remnant of the vital desires and instincts which one had in the body. As soon as one is tired of these, and able to go beyond, the vital sheath is dropped, and the soul, after a little time needed to get rid of some mental survivals, passes into a state of rest in the psychic world, and remains there till the next life on earth." And we're going to see with Savitri that as she goes through some difficult things, finally she gets tired of torturing herself with old vital memories and desires. And then the light comes. A mother said, "What man calls the heavens and hills after death are really the product of his own imagination. Man's imagination is so creative, such a form maker, that there are really places in the inner world like this. Man creates out of nothing the things he imagines." Mother described a true experience of a blissful state after death. She said, "If you have had a spiritual aspiration, and you may have worked consciously to reach the goal of evolution, you are conscious in your psychic being. Then, when you die, it returns to the psychic world, which is a world of bliss, delight, tranquility, and growing knowledge." Savitri does not have to go through the same things that Satchavan has to go through. She has not died. She is very much alive. But her mind has made for her a kind of purgatory over Satchavan's death and how she feels about losing him. Sri Aurobindo does not describe Satchavan's after-death experiences on his journey. Therefore, we don't know what's happening to him. But we have an inner, lower, vital world as Savitri sees and feels it as she reacts in her own way with her own mental and vital. Sri Aurobindo begins this canto by writing, "A while, on the chill, dreadful edge of night, all stood as if a world were doomed to die and waited on the eternal silence brink. Heaven leaned towards them like a cloudy brow of menace through the dim and voiceless hush. As thoughts stand mute on a despairing verge where the last depths plunge into nothingness and the last dreams must end, they paused. In their front were glooms like shadowy wings. Behind them, pale, the lifeless evening was a dead man's gaze. Hungry beyond, the night desired her soul. Everything in Savitri's world is doomed to die, because death is taking Sajivan. Life will be over. She can see that her last dreams must end if Sajivan is taken from her. Most people believe that death is a fixed part of life. It comes, and everything of life is ended. The person is gone forever. Mother and Sri Aurobindo taught that we won't have to go through the death process in the future, even though now we expect, and everybody expects, that it will happen to everyone. How soon this future comes is partly up to us. Mother was very clear that she wanted everyone in the ashram, including the school children, to work on themselves to do this. She said that with the coming of the new force, it will be much easier to do the work in ourselves. This work is the purification of our own attitudes. Mother and Sri Aurobindo are fully conscious beings. They came here well over 100 years ago to bring the new consciousness that now people talk about all over the world. One of the results of the new consciousness will be that man will undergo a faster evolutionary transformation than he has undergone so far. Because nature's much slower transformations have been our evolution so far. And one result is that we will not need to die anymore. But right now, not having to die is still a work in progress. We can take it on as our work, and we will see that what we get is ongoing delight instead of death. This is what Sri Aurobindo and Mother teach. They also explain why man has had to die and had to go through countless births and deaths up to now in the way that evolution continued in the past. Sri Aurobindo said that the very nature of our soul is something that is put forth from the divine to support the evolution. It must continue to take birth until the divine's purpose in evolution is accomplished. One of our lives is only a brief episode in a long history of spiritual evolution in which the soul follows the curve of the line set for the earth. It passes through many lives to complete it. One of the things that our soul does when it is in our body is to evolve us out of material inconscience, the dense unconsciousness of the physical matter which makes up our bodies. We become more and more conscious on the way to the full consciousness of the self which is the all, which is called in India the Atman. Sri Aurobindo said, death is necessary as a process of life, because eternal change of form is the only kind of immortality that our finite living substance can aspire to have. Eternal change of experience is the only infinity which our finite mind, living in our finite body, can attain. The change of our form when we take a new body is necessary because nothing ever stays the same. The very nature of time and space demand variety of experience. Mother and Sri Aurobindo emphasize that we do not cease to be because our physical body ceases to be. Mother explains, there is really no such thing as the end of a person, the end which we call death. There is only an appearance of disappearance based on a limited outlook. But there is no radical change in the vibration of consciousness. Consciousness is immortal in its very nature. Sri Aurobindo said that his experience led him to believe that even if people choose to merge completely with the Supreme Consciousness, there is always some sort of vibration of them as a separate entity somewhere, as long as there is a manifestation of the Supreme. He once wrote to someone, "There is nothing to grieve about, as death means passing over to another country, to which you probably go very often when you are asleep. Death is only a shedding of the body, not a cessation of personal existence. A man is not dead because he goes to another country and changes his clothes to suit that climate." Here is Mother's explanation of one reason why we die. Death is the consequence of the decentralization of consciousness contained in our body. It is only when the consciousness contained in our cells is decentralized that we are dead. The central will of our physical body gives up wanting to hold our cells together. The central will accepts dissolution, and then everything that was held in our body has nothing to hold it together anymore, and over a period of time, it all scatters. Our very cells are held in their form by this centralization of consciousness in them. So long as that power, that energy of centralization is there, the body cannot die. This centralization inside us is produced by nature. It is consciousness that is mechanical. And then here, Mother is going to tell us what we have to do. She says, "We have to replace nature's mechanical centralization of consciousness by a willed centralization that comes from the inner presence of the divine in us. Then it is the divine's will in us that is the centralizing consciousness which holds all of our physical being together. We know that our soul is our greatest source of divine contact. It is the inner presence of the divine in us. When our soul's divine energy holds all our physical being together, we are well on the way to getting beyond the death process." Mother says, the source of the decentralization comes from the inconscient. It is the resistance of the inconscient matter that makes up our physical form. Here is what we can do to change the way things are now. Mother teaches that as long as we can completely substitute the real vibration of the aspiration for progress and transformation for the vibration of deterioration and decentralization, there is no need to die. If we can do this consistently, there comes a point where death loses all meaning. Mother spoke of how powerful and persuasive the ideas of dying are, and how long they have been around. So it's a constant inner work to keep them out of our thinking and to change our attitude all the way into the cells of our physical body. Mother said, there are many causes for the decentralization of the consciousness at death. They are causes which we might call psychological, but to die, we also have to accept the cessation of the centralization of consciousness in our physical form. We have to consent. There is always a moment when we agree to die. We tend to think of dying as one experience that everybody has. But Mother says that everybody really dies in his own way. No two deaths are the same. Every death is different. There are categories of cases of death, but there are as many kinds of death as there are people, and anything is possible. She said that one reason we accept decentralization is that we have a sense of irreparable disharmony or a sort of disgust at carrying on the effort of coordination. Then the will to maintain the cohesion of this centralization abdicates. There is nothing that wants to hold us together any longer, so we dissipate. Another reason Mother gave is that generally what brings about death is the fatigue of the tension of life. So we choose to give up living because we're tired of it. Mother also explained that it is only when the body decomposes that one can be sure the physical body is dead and not before. As long as there is some consciousness left on any plane of the being that belongs to the body still retains some kind of conscious life. When people are dead, according to the current medical definition of death, Mother says there is still a 7-day period in which everything that was in the body disperses. So it takes 7 days for everything to go out. It is not good to burn the body before this 7-day period is over. Mother clearly explains nature's need for human death in the universal transformation process up to now. She says, "The whole universe is always advancing towards a state of perfection that is continually changing. Therefore, everything in us has to advance at the same pace of the universal advancement. All the planes and parts of our being, from the most subtle to the most gross, follow this progression as it goes on. And the higher up the scale one goes, through the vital and up through the mental, more and more subtle, the rhythm of advance more closely resembles the rhythm of the universal development. But the physical world, the body, is rigid by nature, and the strongest characteristic of our body's nature is inertia, is immobility, not moving. Our body is less conscious than our inner parts. Therefore, it has less plasticity and less receptivity. So there is a constant disequilibrium between the rhythm of our inner evolution and the rhythm of the body's evolution. Our physical body cannot keep up with the rhythm of universal progress. This lack of balance, when our physical body can't keep up with the movements of the progress of our mind and our vital, ends in rupture. Something breaks, and we die. Here again, Mother explains what we have to do. She explains how we overcome the body's slower pace of progress. If we could infuse enough consciousness into our physical matter to follow the same rhythm which the mind and the vital follow, if our bodies could become plastic enough to follow the inner progression, the rupture of balance within us would not occur, and death would no longer be necessary. We cannot do this all alone. Mother says that we should open ourselves to the new consciousness, the new power which is manifesting now. The new consciousness carries within it the capacity to infuse the vibration which can transform our physical substance and make it more supple and plastic and progressive. This new supramental consciousness carries the change. It is the change, and it does the change. Mother also tells us what will overcome the inertia that slows down the body's progress. She says that now the body needs to sit down and rest after some progress has been made. But if our body felt within itself the ardor to always do better, to become more beautiful, more luminous and clear, if the body wanted to be eternally young, one could escape death. The solution is to work with our body to improve all its functions and capacities, and as part of that work, to infuse these positive creative attitudes into our own cells so that they will willingly and consciously participate in their own evolution. Mother and Sri Aurobindo used the term supramental transformation in the context of speeding up the pace of universal evolution to a very great degree. Then there would be a complete change in our physical body in a relatively short time, as the new supramental forces continue to manifest here. They also said that universal evolution is an endlessly ongoing transformation at the slow pace of universal nature. We never stop being transformed. Leaving the body by dying and then being reborn are part of our endless transformation. So you cannot call death a denial of life or an end of life. It is part of the ongoing experience of life. We wear out our bodies and have to come back and take new ones to play our part in the curve of progress set for the earth. When people hear the word transformation, they tend to concentrate on the descriptions of the supramental transformation. This is the end result of the accelerated transformation that can now take place with the new forces coming. But it helps to remember that we are always being transformed by universal evolution. Mother came here to conquer death. And Savitri's story is Mother's story. On her way to do this, Savitri now faces the experience of vast total emptiness of life as death takes Satyavan through the inconscient. Her spirit, which has opposed death from the first, faces the abyss, the bottomless gulf of eternal darkness. Her spirit is a torch of fire, pointing against the breast of darkness, like a weapon. Sri Aurobindo writes, "But still, in its lone niche of templed strength motionless, her flame-bright spirit, mute, erect, burned like a torch fire from a windowed room, pointing against the darkness' somber breast." The woman first affronted the abyss, daring to journey through the eternal night. Armored with light, she advanced her foot to plunge into the dread and hueless vacancy. Immortal, unappalled, her spirit faced the danger of the ruthless, eyeless waste. As Savitri leaves behind the inconscience rock gate's heavy walls, earthly time has no meaning for her anymore. So the present and the past seem to lapse back into timelessness, and the future seems to end, drowned in nothingness. But this is all part of her spiritual agony of a dream, just like we do to ourselves. Savitri's terrible dream is that because back in her life with Satyavan, she experienced the terror of losing him, a huge, pitiless void made of terror now surrounds her, and she is devoured by its shadowy, strangling mass. She cannot even think anymore. She feels she cannot breathe in the smothering stress of this stupendous naught, this huge nothingness. This is what fear and terror do to all of us. Then Sri Aurobindo explains to us what is still in Savitri's consciousness that brings about this experience of terrible loneliness and isolation. He writes, "On all that claims here to be truth and God and conscious self and the revealing word and the creative rapture of the mind, and love, and knowledge, and heart's delight, there fell the immense refusal of the eternal no. The eternal no is hiding in everybody's consciousness. It comes out from time to time, and it makes our life miserable, and everybody's life miserable. It's good to know that we have this inside us, because it explains something of why we are the way we are and why other people are the way they are. When we can recognize it in ourselves, we can reject it. We can work with it. We can get rid of the eternal no." Sri Aurobindo writes about the eternal no in Savitri at least two times in his own yoga, the yoga of Savitri's father, King Ashwapati, the traveler of the worlds. This great yogi comes to a place in his own inward journey where he attains the experience of the silent self behind all things. Later on, Sri Aurobindo writes that it is the sheer self-discovery of the soul. He describes his experience this way. A being, formless, featureless, and mute, that knew itself by its own timeless self, aware forever in its motionless depths, uncreating, uncreated, and unborn, the one by whom all live, who lives by none, an immeasurable luminous secrecy guarded by the veils of the unmanifest, above the changing cosmic interlude, abode supreme, immutably the same. A silent cause, occult, impenetrable, infinite, eternal, unthinkable, alone. Sri Aurobindo tells us that the king is now in the boundless silence of the self, beyond thought, beyond ego, beyond being, beyond care. But this is not enough. Sri Aurobindo writes to the king and to us, O soul, it is too early to rejoice. Escape brings not the victory and the crown. Something thou camest to do from the unknown, but nothing is finished, and the work goes on because only half God's cosmic work is done. Only the everlasting no has neared, and stared into thy eyes, and killed thy heart. But where is the lover's everlasting yes, and immortality in the secret heart? This too is truth at the mystic fount of life. This speaks directly to Savitri's condition. The lover and the love are the Supreme's own truth, and this comes from the source of immortal life. This is what Savitri has to be in, the lover's everlasting yes, not the ignorant falsehood of the so-called everlasting no. This is what we all have to be in to conquer death. The king also finds the everlasting no hidden in himself when he has to do the final yoga to make himself ready to see the Divine Mother. He wants to ask her to come to earth to help mankind to progress. Sri Aurobindo writes, In the texture of our bound humanity, he felt the stark resistance, huge and dumb, of our inconscient and unseeing base, the stubborn mute rejection in life's depths, the ignorant no in the origin of things. A veiled collaboration with the night, even in himself, survived and hid from his view. Still, something in his earthly being kept its kinship with the inconscient whence it came. This he now willed to discover and exile. So the king strips bare all of nature's hidden spaces in his being and searches all of them with fire. This is his last and final yogic work that he has to do to be able to meet the Divine Mother. This also speaks directly to Savitri's condition and to us. We have the will to conquer the falsehood of the ignorant no at our origin, and we have to use that will. Savitri is moving through the inconscient, the origin of the ignorant no. Since it is still a part of her being, it has a strong effect on her here. Savitri's love for Satyavan is behind her will. It is the lover's everlasting eternal yes to all joy and all delight, the eternal purpose of life itself. But now, as the ignorant no emerges in Savitri's consciousness, she enters into the shadows. And in the darkness, her eyes have lost their luminous Satyavan. Yet, Sri Aurobindo writes, But not for this her spirit failed, but held more deeply than the bounded senses can, which grasp externally and find, to lose, its object loved. Savitri has done all this throughout her marriage with Satyavan. Her spirit was with him and conscious of what he did, even when they were not physically together. She felt everything. But Savitri still feels deep pain because Satyavan is being taken away from her. So she becomes filled with abysmal loneliness, and she travels in pain for what seems a long time. But then Sri Aurobindo gives us the truth that, like all of us, Savitri is doing all this to herself. It is all self-torture, and she holds on to it for far too long. He writes, "Solitary in the anguish of the void, she lived in spite of death. She conquered still. In vain her puissant being was oppressed. Her heavy, long monotony of pain, tardily, of its fierce self-torture, tired." Then Sri Aurobindo so beautifully describes how the immortal light in Savitri shows to the falsehood of her darkness its lack of truth. Savitri sees her own dark terror. She sees its falsehood. Night tries in vain to make Savitri believe that her darkness is also immortal. Sri Aurobindo writes that night saw in herself the tenebrous absolute. Tenebrous means dark or obscure. The dark absolute is Nirguna Brahman, the negative Brahman of the emptiness side of the Supreme. We saw that this is the Nirvana that Savitri has realized. But one has to have both the negative Brahman and the positive Brahman, Nirguna Brahman and Saguna Brahman. And since it is all Brahman, even the darkness is eternal light. So night cannot be everything for Savitri. Savitri's immortal soul cannot be covered forever by the falsehood of her own darkness. At first, the immortal light is just a gleam, a ray that Sri Aurobindo describes as a dangerous ray, dangerous to the darkness. But immortal light must remove all darkness, no matter how large the darkness seems. Savitri's immortal soul partner is the immortal soul of Satyavan. Eternally, his soul is the joy and delight of her soul and of her whole being. Darkness is nothing at all in front of this. And Sri Aurobindo writes, "But still the light prevailed, and still it grew. And Savitri, to her lost self, awoke. Her limbs refused the cold embrace of death. Her heartbeats triumphed in the grasp of pain. Her soul persisted, claiming for its joy the soul of the beloved now seen no more. Before her, in the stillness of the world, once more she heard the treading of a god. And out of the dumb darkness, Satyavan, her husband, grew into a luminous shade." The Book of Eternal Night. The Journey in Eternal Night and the Voice of the Darkness. A while, on the chill, dreadful edge of night, all stood as if a world were doomed to die and waited on the eternal silence brink. Heaven leaned toward them like a cloudy brow of menace through the dim and voiceless hush. As thoughts stand mute on a despairing verge where the last depths plunge into nothingness and the last dreams must end, they paused. In their front were glooms like shadowy wings. Behind them, pale, the lifeless evening was a dead man's gaze. Hungry beyond, the night desired her soul. But still, in its lone niche of templed strength motionless, her flame-bright spirit, mute, erect, burned like a torch fire from a windowed room pointing against the darkness' somber breast. The woman first affronted the abyss, daring to journey through the eternal night. Armored with light, she advanced her foot to plunge into the dread and hueless vacancy. Immortal, unappalled, her spirit faced the danger of the ruthless eyeless waste. Against night's inky ground they stirred, molding mysterious motion on her human tread, a swimming action and a drifting march, like figures moving before eyelids closed. All as in dreams went slipping, gliding on. The rock gate's heavy walls were left behind, as if through passages of receding time, present and past into the timeless lapsed. Arrested upon dim adventure's brink, the future ended, drowned in nothingness. Amid collapsing shapes they wound obscure. The fading vestibules of a tenebrous world received them, where they seemed to move, and yet be still, nowhere advancing, yet to pass. A dumb procession, a dim picture bounds, not conscious forms threading a real scene. A mystery of terror's boundlessness, gathering its hungry strength, the huge, pitiless void, surrounded slowly with its soundless depths, and monstrous, cavernous, a shapeless throat devoured her into its shadowy, strangling mass. The fierce spiritual agony of a dream. A curtain of impenetrable dread, the darkness hung round her cage of sense, as when the trees have turned to blotted shades and the last friendly glimmer fades away around a bullock in a forest tied by hunters, closes in no empty night. The thought that strives in the world was here unmade. Its effort it renounced to live and know, convinced at last that it had never been. It perished, all its dream of action done. This clotted cipher was its dark result. In the smothering stress of this stupendous knot, mind could not think, breath could not breathe, the soul could not remember or feel itself. It seemed a hollow gulf of sterile emptiness, a zero oblivious of the sum it closed, an abnegation of the maker's joy, saved by no wide repose, no depth of peace. On all that claims here to be truth and God, and conscious self, and the revealing word, and the creative rapture of the mind, and love, and knowledge, and heart's delight, there fell the immense refusal of the eternal no. As disappears a golden lamp in gloom, born into distance from the eye's desire, into the shadows vanished Savitri. There was no course, no path, no end or goal. Visionless, she moved amid insensible gulfs, or drove through some great black unknowing waste, or whirled in a dumb eddy of meeting winds assembled by the titan hands of chance. There was none with her in the dreadful vast. She saw no more the vague, tremendous god. Her eyes had lost their luminous Sachavan. Yet not for this her spirit failed, but held more deeply than the bounded senses can, which grasp externally, and find, to lose, its object loved. So, when on earth they lived, she had felt him straying through the glades a scene in her, its clefts her being's vistas, opening their secrets to his search and joy, because, to jealous sweetness in her heart, whatever happy space his cherished feet preferred must be at once her soul embracing his body, passioning dumbly to his tread. But now a silent gulf between them came, and to abysmal loneliness she fell, even from herself cast out, from love remote. Long hours, since long it seems, when sluggish time is measured by the throbs of the soul's pain, in an unreal darkness, empty and drear, she traveled, treading on the corpse of life, lost in a blindness of extinguished souls. Solitary in the anguish of the void, she lived in spite of death, she conquered still. In vain her puissant being was oppressed. Her heavy long monotony of pain, tardily of its fierce self-torture tired. At first a faint inextinguishable gleam, pale but immortal, flickered in the gloom, as if a memory came to spirits dead, a memory that wished to live again, dissolved from mind in nature's natal sleep. It wandered like a lost ray of the moon, revealing to the night her soul of dread. Serpentine in the gleam the darkness lolled, its black hoods jeweled with the mystic glow. Its dull, sleek folds shrank back and coiled and slid, as though they felt all light a cruel pain, and suffered from the pale approach of hope. Night felt assailed her heavy, somber reign. The splendor of some bright eternity threatened with this faint beam of wandering truth, her empire of the everlasting naught. Implacable in her intolerant strength, and confident that she alone was true, she strove to stifle the frail, dangerous ray. Aware of an all-negating immensity, she reared her giant head of nothingness, her mouth of darkness swallowing all that is. She saw in herself the tenebrous absolute. But still the light prevailed, and still it grew, and Savitri to her lost self awoke. Her limbs refused the cold embrace of death. Her heartbeats triumphed in the grasp of pain. Her soul persisted, claiming for its joy the soul of the beloved now seen no more. Before her, in the stillness of the world, once more she heard the treading of a god. And out of the dumb darkness, Satyavan, her husband, grew into a luminous shade.